So anyway, we just want to talk to you for a little bit because, you know, you've thought a lot about this crisis and, of course, about Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan's role in it. And I guess, you know, you've written about this, but at the risk of making you repeat yourself, you know, why did Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan emerge so much less damaged than everyone else?
I think there's probably a number of contributing factors. One would be the fortress balance sheet approach, which, you know, you can read about in any number of articles going all the way back to Sandy Weill and Citigroup before, you know, the current version of Citigroup, and the idea being this sort of buy straw hats in winter approach to capital management. Jamie learned from Sandy and I think continued to practice it at Bank One and later at J.P. Morgan that that the best time to capitalize, on opportunities is when everyone else is suffering. And in order to be able to do that, you have to be, build a business and a capital structure that puts you at an advantage in a downturn or when there's big changes sweeping through an industry. So they stuck to that, and it was a real focus through the entire, he'd only been at J.P. Morgan, I think, about 3 or 4 years once we were in the grip of the crisis, but they were better capitalized. Another thing which, is related, but it's really a separate issue, is a focus on detail, which he is also quite famous for. I think that differentiated him from Sandy a little bit. Jamie was Sandy's detail guy. And you'll see there's a Fortune piece written by Sean Tully, and it's repeated in my book and repeated elsewhere that their focus on detail and sort of making sure that they understood all the different dynamics of the business led them to a realization in 2007 by connecting some dots that there were weaknesses in a number of areas of subprime and less quality borrowers, whether it was in their credit cards, in their home lending, or in their securitization efforts. And they notably pulled back from some of these securitization efforts specifically before others and had less of some of these structures on their books than others did. Jamie said to me, and he said elsewhere too, that at the end of 06 and in 07, they were getting a lot of heat from Wall Street analysts for not having grown some of their debt capital markets business as quickly as the competition, but they claimed that was on purpose. And so they pulled back from some of the much riskier parts of the business. So they've had billions of dollars of write-downs just by virtue of size, but relatively speaking, less than some others like Merrill and Citi and Lehman. And then there's another thing which gets mentioned in the book as well, which is they were lucky. You know, some of the other institutions had a to have a fully functioning fluid securitization engine in place. What you needed was origination, and the ability to package and hand off out the other end your securitized product. And there's a number of people who said that they were in the process of, while they weren't ramping up securitization specifically, they were in the process of ramping up their ability to securitize in the sense of having the right people in place. They'd had some management turnover because the origination and securitization teams didn't like each other, and so some people got fired, and they were in the process of sort of rebuilding that conveyor belt when all hell broke loose. So there are some who say, you just weren't ready to be going at this at the rate that Merrill and others were. You know, Jamie and those guys will say that's totally untrue, but there is an argument that, you know, they were just you know, not in the wrong place at the wrong time by virtue of you know, historical detail.
Right. Let me ask you about one aspect of the business. I mean, J.P. Morgan Chase was very, I think they were the largest trader in over-the-counter derivatives, which, you know, is a market that burned a lot of people, especially AIG. How did they get into that murky world without getting singed?
Well, part of my answer will be somewhat sort of speculation, because I don't really know. I don't know the details of any, you know, specific derivatives contracts that they hold. But for starters, I think one issue is they are they're a broker, so. I think they remain the largest player in OTC derivatives today, but in large part they're just the middleman. And if you go to their website, you can see at their Investor Day meeting in February, they have some charts that break down their exposures. If you go through all the netting exercises, as in, you know, netting out exposure due to the fact that there's someone on the other side or that they've hedged themselves out of a risk that they held on their books, their relative exposure drops from, you know, X trillion or whatever it is down to in the tens of billions. Still a large number, but not anywhere near the nominal value of derivatives that are attributed to them.
Right.
But I think the key is that they're not AIG. AIG was just took the wrong side of billions of dollars of bets. And when the bet came due, they were the loser. So I think it's really about them being a broker rather than much of a speculator in the market. One would assume, given that they have to have some proprietary action in there, if only as a result of being a market maker sometimes, that they're good at hedging their risk.
Right.
I try and get to the point in the book. I'm not of the I personally am not. I'm of the sort of Warren Buffett camp that, you know, derivatives are in and of themselves not dangerous things. You know, they just are what they are. They're only dangerous if, you know, in the wrong hands, like a gun or something. So, prudently managed derivatives exposure is just like any other exposure. And it appears like clearly they're better at managing their derivatives exposure than they are at managing their mortgage exposure. You know, the business of Chase obviously is to give loans. So there's the, there's a line from Bob Willemstad, a city guy, and he was ultimately at AIG for a time, who says, you know, when you're a bank, you can't outrun the economy. So at some point, if you're a bank, if we're in a huge downturn, you're going to suffer in some parts of your business, and they are suffering. Their credit card is suffering. Their mortgage is suffering. But their OTC derivatives business, I think, is relatively unscathed because in that, they're managing their exposures as a broker really well.
Right. You had a question about risk management?
Yeah, I have a variety of questions, if I might. Let me go back to a Fortress balance sheet. You had said basically that they were better capitalized than anybody else. When you look at what was going on, was it being better capitalized that counted rather than just sort of if everybody had been well capitalized, would Jamie Dimon have still come out of this well, or was it that they had a relative advantage that made the big difference?
Don't hold me to better than everyone else. I'm sure there's, one or two other institutions, but I really do, and I really got the sense from talking to analysts and people whose job is to focus on capital structure, that was the competitive advantage. Now, the key is that it isn't until it is.
Mm-hmm.
So in 05, 06, 07, you look at the stock price performance, even the business, the P&L performance of places like Merrill in particular and Lehman. If you recall, like, until Lehman was in all the trouble that it was the sort of success story of the decade, you know, how Dick Fuld took a bank that was second tier and made it first tier again. And in the process of doing that, it was by ramping up the risk, in particular in securitization for both Merrill and Lehman, and that juiced their profits. So J.P. Morgan underperformed both on an absolute profitability basis and on a market performance basis because they were relatively more conservative until the instant that it actually mattered, and then things reversed.
So he really did have a perception that, as that well-known anecdote, every 5 years the markets go south, and that's when he would jump. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, something like that. You know, I got tagged. The New York Times book review of my book criticized it for complimenting him on having, you know, better timing than the competition. They were in securitized products. They were making subprime loans. They were making no-doc loans. They were making irresponsible lending decisions. But on the whole, less than everyone else, and they stopped sooner. So they were in the business.
Yeah.
But the safeguards and the triggers or alarms or whatever went off earlier and didn't allow the same kind of exposures. One of the, you know, Dimon will get in the game if the economics are there, but also has a consistent approach to keeping exposures within some range that is acceptable to the firm. Whereas if you looked at Merrill, I'm sure at some point along the line, a very tiny proportion of their business on an absolute level had them, you know, disproportionately exposed to the downside. Jamie's whole philosophy is about not letting certain users of firm capital have leave it disproportionately exposed. And that lesson they learned from Salomon Brothers in 87 when they bought it at Citi, and that you had the derivatives traders there basically, you know, getting preferential use of the firm capital and exposing it in ways that put the rest of the firm at risk. And ever since then, his whole managerial philosophy is that, sure, you can take risks, that's the business they're in, but you have to manage it, and you have to watch its proportional possibilities on the rest of the business.
So they are one of the few firms that early in the game had a risk committee of the board and seemed to build in serious risk management. Is that a fair statement?
I would say that's extremely clear in retrospect.
Then let me try to put two things together. When you read the good governance literature, the whole concept is one of checks and balances. A strong, capable board that can hold a CEO, think Richard Fuld, you can just add to the list, in check, so they don't go too far in betting the bank. What was the relationship of Mr. Diamond to his board here?
Well, you certainly have sort of focused in on what the great contradiction of Diamond, which is why people always say if a better future means that we have to have Jamie Dimon running every financial institution out there, then we're in trouble. I don't think he'll get good grades for corporate governance because he's got both chairman and CEO roles.
Yeah.
The board is not, the board feels extremely well informed. I managed to speak to about a half a dozen of the board members, but they're certainly taking his lead. Jamie is a guy that I think the board and even the people who work for him are willing to say, you know what, it's working now, so we're not going to sort of push for the split role or for some extra percentage of outside directors. I think he's, you know, by force of will and power, just, you know, it's his show. And if anything goes wrong there of serious magnitude, people will be able to point back to that and say, well, look, you know what? Nobody was a check on Jamie. So, yeah, it's an issue.
Let me try to push the flip side of that. If the board's well informed about risks that are being run, do they have any? Are they better informed about that stuff than they are about other aspects of the business? And the subtext of the question is that because Jamie Dimon cares about risk, so he built it in?
I think so. You know, I've never been in a board meeting of J.P. Morgan, so I can't really talk specifically about it. But they do feel, you know, I talked to a number of them about the acquisition of Bear Stearns, and, you know, that was a really fast-moving and variable changing transaction. But the board members told me that they felt fully informed of every aspect of the decision through the process. So is it built in? Do they feel as comfortable as they think that they could be? I think so.
Very interesting. Now, the one piece you've not talked about that, at least from my readings, seems to come through. If you look at a company like Wamo that went out and did a whole bunch of acquisitions, the pieces didn't really talk to each other. But if you look at J.P. Morgan Chase, at least some of the readings seem to suggest that Mr. Dimon was very concerned to build a technology platform so that he could look at the entire business in an integrated way, including the risk part of it. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. He's had a reputation since Bank One at being focused on consolidation of information systems in particular. If you look at the company press releases about integration and conversion of WaMu branches after that acquisition, you'll see that it happened remarkably fast, not only in the physical sense of converting them to Chase branches, but also the IT conversion of getting them all on the same platforms. I think that is a notable focus there. Frank Bisignano, who's the chief administrative officer, told me that Jamie has insisted that they be able to handle two major acquisitions at once, not just one. So they have the capability in place. They actually bid on Washington Mutual in April of 2008, before who won that bid, TPG or someone, and then it came back to them in September. But they had just agreed to buy Bear Stearns, and they were about to do both at once. And I think part of that focus is really the back office administrative capability of handling and switching it over. So, yes.
When we look at Jamie Dimon as a very strong CEO, there's a phenomenon that we used to call the Indira Gandhi phenomenon, where she would cut down anybody that was halfway competent at the next rank because she didn't want to be challenged. What does the next rank look like at J.P. Morgan Chase?
Well, it's certainly not cut down. There's he got burned at Citi, obviously, being fired by Sandy Weill, and he sort of admitted his own parts, his role in creating a situation that was no longer tenuous. But part of that was the lack of clarity over succession, or even process over succession. They just announced some management changes 6 or 8 weeks ago, where three members of the management committee took on new roles with the express goal of broadening their experience and understanding of the different businesses. If you know, the who will succeed Jamie story has been written a number of times, including by me. And the interesting thing about that is that there's a half a dozen names that you would put on the short list that wouldn't shock the market or internal observers if any of them took over. So I think he's actually doing a conscientious job of preparing for succession. He has two succession plans. One is the hit by a bus succession plan.
Yeah.
And he said he's already given the board a couple of names in that event. The obvious one today is Jess Staley, who runs the investment bank. He's Jamie's age, though. So at some, with every passing year, he becomes a less viable long-term succession candidate. And then there's the true succession and planned succession. There's a number of people, one level down.
Let me take you back to Bear for a second. Obviously he saw a good opportunity, to pick up some distressed assets at a good time, and he was lucky enough to have the government help back him up in doing that. Was his? I'm curious, not just as the CEO and chairman of the board of JP Morgan Chase, but as a citizen, did he think that the entire financial system was in danger with a bear collapse? I mean, how worried was he at that point in the crisis?
He says he was really worried. He says that he did that deal for a couple of reasons. You know, first they got the call and they were like, of course we'll look over the books. You know, we're open to anything. And back to my point about straw hats in winter, it was like things were just starting to come around to Jamie Dimon's way of doing things in early '08. But they ultimately said no to Paulson and Geithner and Bernanke twice, and the government backstop of the $30 billion of loans was the concession made by the government to get them to come around, because they actually decided that they couldn't come to terms with what was then a $400 billion balance sheet in the amount of time they had, which was a weekend. And so they had a vote inside J.P. Morgan at one point where they said no. And so he called, I can't remember who he called, it's in the book, he called Paulson or someone and said, we just can't do it. And then they came back and said, you know, how can we help you to do it? So that $30 billion was added. But he'll tell you, and he told Charlie Rose. Charlie Rose was the first major interview he did after that, was that definitely there was patriotism involved. Patriotism and self-preservation. Like, I don't know how you unlink the two. Like, he did think the system was at risk. He did think it was something they had to do for the country. But at the same time, he insisted in carrying out his role as a fiduciary of trying to get as close or as good a deal as he could for his own shareholders, because that's his job.
Right.
And that's where the backstop came in. I think if Geithner and Paulson hadn't insisted, they wouldn't have done the deal.
Right.
So they did it because they felt like they had to.
Right. Let me just ask a quick follow-up. Did he I mean, I know he was, they were not central in the weekend of Lehman's collapse. But does Dimon hold a view about whether Lehman should have been allowed to go down? I mean, does he think?
People will say they're a little more central than he, like, they were making collateral calls on Lehman.
Right. Well, they were certainly, I mean, people say they were helped put the nail in Lehman.
Yeah. And his response to that is, what do you want us to do? Right. Like, we had our own shareholders' money at risk, and it was clearly at risk, and we acted within our rights of, you know.
Yeah, no, it seems no different than what Goldman did with AIG. And
it seems no different than anybody acting on behalf of their own owners.
No, I just meant whether you
have a responsibility of you know, being able to have bifocals and think of the system itself at the same time that you're taking of your own specific needs, right? Like, that's the whole issue of, like, of crowd selling, right?
Right.
Like, if we all do this, we're all fucked. But his opinion on Lehman, I think he's... I can't even remember if we got specifically and do you think it should have happened. He had a certain amount of sympathy for Paulson and Geithner, saying, you know, there's going to be all sorts of retrospective criticism of these guys, but he made an analogy. It's like sitting in a seat beside a boxing ring and telling a boxer, hey, don't let him punch you like that. Like, they're in the ring, and they're fighting, and they're making whatever decisions they can. So I think one is he thought they were acting in good faith. But more importantly, he does think that the system needs to let failure run its course. So I would say that I think he's okay with the way things played out. Like, it got more severe than anyone expected, but I don't think you'd find him saying, no, we should have saved Lehman, and we should have saved whoever else, and we should have saved whoever else.
Right.
He wouldn't tell you that.
Well, we appreciate your time. We got just a couple more, and then we'll let you get back to your real job.
I know you're working on an additional book about the crisis, but this strong leader issue and how Jamie, you know, sort of made the deal work, considering his role, you know, with JPMC. Have you thought at all about compare and contrast, maybe with the B of A and the Merrill deal, where there was, maybe not the relationship that Jamie appears to have with Paulson and Geithner?
I don't know enough about Ken Lewis to comment that much on that. I can tell you just anecdotally, there's far fewer people like Ken Lewis than you know, liked or got along with Diamond. And that's in part because he's an outsider from their club.
That's right.
And Jamie's the ultimate insider in that club. Sorry, what's the actual question again?
No, I just, B of A did a deal. I think that's a very interesting observation, though, about being an insider, Ken Lewis being an outsider. I think that's a good takeaway.
Well, yeah, and the deal itself was nowhere near the same kind of deal. He overpaid.
That's right.
And he overpaid at a far more crucial time when it was becoming much more clear that there could be significant changes in the underlying economic environment. So I think just as a business judgment point, Lewis's timing and negotiation of the deal came up short when compared to either the Bear Stearns or the WaMu deal.
I want to go to your point about Jamie Dimon being liked by so many people. I had occasion, I talked to some mild-mannered government type who said, Jamie Dimon, he said, just Google the words Jamie Dimon and ruthless and see what you come up with. And
oh, yeah. I had to, let me restate that. Maybe liked is the wrong word. He's respected. And I had to come up with a number of ways to sort of come up with synonyms for asshole in my book, like gruff charm, or like he is not the most cuddly guy, but he's actually, I said to people I loved spending time with him, but I'd never want to work for him. He's actually, he is likable, you know, if you're not on the wrong end of, you know, his detail fixation or his, you know, you made a mistake thing or you're not working hard enough. You know, nobody gets where he's gotten without having some seriously sharp edges. But in the Bush Gore, who'd you want to have a beer with thing, You'd want the beer with Diamond before Ken Lewis. You'd want it with Diamond before Dick Fuld. You want it with Diamond before Lloyd Blankfein. You know, there's, I'm sure there are other guys out there that I'm sure Sandy Weill is a guy people had a lot of good times with. But there's something, you know, people are there's no shortage of people who think he's got more credit than he deserves, that books like mine were just, you know, hero worship. But my whole point in response to that is, okay, look, who's the king right now? You could argue that maybe Lloyd is, in a sense, because Goldman is still managing to keep it together. But their public relations, their handling of public relations, like even the thing with you guys, it's just like, Jesus.
Yeah. Well, there was
like, what school of PR did you go to?
Well, there is that.
And Jamie's sort of, whatever the drawbacks are, and he's certainly not like the sweetest person. It's, you know what, whatever the mix is, it's working better than everybody else's mix right now. And at some level, guys on Wall Street admire that kind of success over all else. So when I said liked, I think that they, you know, he gets the respect for the results as much as the process.
Well, Dove, thank you. It was nice of you to
was great. Thanks.
It was nice of you to take the time out, and I paid retail for your book.
Excellent. I appreciate it.
And hey, I ordered it, too.
No Kindle. Full retail, paper.
Good stuff.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot. Have a nice day. Good luck with the report.
Thank you. Bye-bye.